Hi, my name's Deb, and I am a compulsive debtor, spender, and under-earner. And thank you to all six of you who stayed for the very last presentation. Keeps me humble. Woohoo! if people have not had a chance to stand up and stretch, please do. It's important to take care of yourself. I want to thank the committee that made this fellowship day possible. You are awesome. This is a nice space. Yay! And thanks to Roger for hanging in there and looking interested. I'm expecting that to happen now, actually. Roger also needs, as he says, some Sherpas after the meeting to cart things out. And a Sherpa is a indentured servant. Okay. In preparing for this today, I got a very clear message, don't. So we're going to see what God has to say. I've been given the honor of speaking about the steps, which always amazes me that I am asked to do this because I resisted working the program for quite some time. I worked, as somebody else said, a 12-tool program, and I experienced miracles, by the way. But one of the things I learned fairly quickly was that tools do not result in recovery. They result in a cleaner life, but they don't result in the spiritual experience that's needed to transform me from being the hopeless addict that I am on my own power. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening, as the result of these steps, by the way, it doesn't say a result of these steps, the result of these steps, we carry the message. So I need the 12 steps to transform this addict, this biochemical addict, from being who she is into being somebody better and different. And that is always going to be an ongoing process. So I would like to tell you what my emotional and spiritual experience is of the 12 steps. And I will start with a story. There was a man who was planning his eternal future, and he couldn't decide whether to go to heaven or hell. So he went to hell and had a little chat with Satan and said, you know, I'd like to interview some people here and see if this is where I want to be. Satan said, no, no problem. You can stay as long as you want, leave whenever you want. And he said, cool. So he started walking through hell, and he saw these people who were very well-dressed and very looking very prosperous. But they were all deeply, deeply miserable. And he went up to them and said, why are you so miserable? And they said, you know, we're not sure, but you'll find out. So he finished his interviewing in a couple days and went back to the gates of hell. And noticed there's a sign beside the gate that said, with his name on it, before you leave hell, you must complete these two tasks. Well, he didn't remember that being part of the agreement, but he went and did the tasks and came back to the door a couple days later, and there was another sign up on the door with his name on it that said, before leaving hell, you need to complete these four assignments. And he started getting the first little wiggle of fear. And he went and completed the four assignments and approached the gate with dread. And by cracky, there was his name up on that sign again. It said, you must complete the following eight tasks before you can leave hell. And then he got it. That was why everybody was so miserable. And he cried and cried. And he cried so hard he fell asleep. And when he fell asleep, he had a dream. And in the dream, he walked up to the gates of hell, and there was a sign there that said, you must complete these 16 tasks before you leave hell. And he knew it was for eternity. And he turned back with great dread and depression to complete the 16 tasks, knowing it was pointless. And then something made him reach out and turn the doorknob, and the gates were open. Well, he woke up, and he thought, could it be that I could... No, it's just a dream. And he trudged up to the gates of hell, and there was the sign. You must complete these following 16 tasks before you leave hell. And he turned around to do it, and then he thought, well, what the hell? And he reached out, and he tapped the door, and it opened. That, to me, is what the 12 steps are about. I get to choose whether I participate in the solution or in the problem. It's up to me. Step one for me resulted in a one-liner. There is no one who is going to rescue me anymore. Not because I choose to, but because they've died. and I've used everybody. I had no other options left. I was lots of money in debt. So that insight came 2 years ago, and I've been in this 12-step program since 1991. It took me that long to get honest. I went up to a woman who I fear slightly in the meeting, who is very clear, and I said to her, I'm really scared. I know the steps and I know the tools, and I'm using my savings, and I don't know where it's going, and I'm starting to feel crazy. And she said, have you worked the steps in DA? And I said, well, and by the way, anybody who answers that question with, well, busted. What I was trying to do was I was trying to use the osmosis program and other 12-step groups. I always made sure that money was part of my other fourth-step inventories. Blah, blah, blah. No, I had not worked the steps in DA. And guess what? I didn't have the miracle of DA. So she said, well, we're going to work the steps in DA because that's all I have to give you. And she was very blunt with me. So she walked me through steps one in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, steps two. By the way, there are questions and answers in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Step three. And when I got to step four, I got a real wake-up call about how I was expressing my disease today, back then 2 years ago. And I came up with a list of warning signs for mid-timers. The first one on the list was trying to work the program without working the steps, or working the steps through other programs hoping it'll transfer over. That was number one. Another one was perpetual vagueness, even though I most of the time occasionally would keep my numbers kind of sorta. You know. But you know, I had some paperwork, so that made me valid. Having sporadic PRGs with people who were safe, translated not in recovery. Not being willing to ask people who I wanted to be part of my PRGs that hard question. Do you have 90 days of back-to-back sobriety, and are you working with a sponsor on the steps? Those are hard questions to ask for those of us who are chronic codependents. I was doing all those things, dipping into savings, not keeping track of them, what I was doing. And what had led into that, first off, that I had savings was a miracle, but I had inherited those savings. My father died. And I inherited over $100,000. And that is that's the dream of every single one of us. How many of you, just by a show of hands, for those of us, fantasize about the lottery? Okay. Oh, be honest. Okay, we got a pretty good showing on that one. How many people still fantasize about the somebody or something that's going to rescue them from their current level of worry? Signpost 12. It's been documented nationally, internationally. We're not alone. There's a stretch of highway in Rochester, Minnesota that has a great big billboard that shows you the current number in the Powerball. And I call that the most dangerous half mile of freeway in the United States. Because you know what we're doing. Yep. Part of my abstinence is not to fantasize about the lottery, because it really disconnects me from God. Anyways, moving on to the steps. My experience of steps two and three is an ongoing one, and I wish I could talk more about that, and I don't have time right now. Step four was very powerful for me. It was an opportunity for me to be crystal clear in the program of Debtors Anonymous. And I got to document extraordinary levels of resentment. I had pages and pages, and I've done some pretty concrete, clear fourth steps in other programs. In DA, I found out that I had a chronic resentment of people who have money. I have a chronic resentment of any institution or entity that has money. When I got to step five and sat with my sponsor and gave that away, it didn't take very long. But she pointed out to me my pattern of having these chronic resentments and using that to keep myself paralyzed from being responsible for my own life. I was always out there focusing on somebody else. Either they had what I wanted, not in a good way, or they owed me. when I got to six, I really expected to spend months on six. And she asked me a question that really was quite touching. We had just gone through my format, and she asked me just to read the fourth column, which is what character defects were operative with each one of my resentments. And she taught me something. She said, when you have a resentment, all of those character defects in column four have been activated, all of them, not one or two, because I was kind of picking and choosing. She said all of them are activated, so you get to document how they've been activated, not if they've been activated. And when I got to column four, I had a very long list of my character defects. And when we got to step six, she said, do you find these objectionable? And I don't remember ever being asked that question, but it's in the big book. Do we find these objectionable? And I found I had a conscience. And I said, yeah, I do. And I felt it in here. It wasn't just this is the next thing I need to do to blast through the steps. I felt it in here. I felt my soul cringe at how I lie, cheat, steal, and rearrange reality to suit my very sick perception of how my money life should be. So right then, she moved me on to seven, and we said the seventh step prayer together. And I had a spiritual experience at that moment. I had a spiritual experience of, this is where language isn't real good. I had an experience of something being lifted from within me. And I wish I could tell you that I walked out of there, hallelujah, I'm free, you know, I'm earning what I need, blah, blah, blah. But what I mostly had was a personalization of the program. It's personal for me, for this addict. Eight was fairly easy. I already had the paperwork done, a list of people I'd harmed. Nine got real interesting because I was very vague. I could not figure out how to make amends to the people on my fourth step and eighth step list. I just couldn't do it. I kept saying, I'm running out of ideas. You know, I came up with living amends. And she said, no, these, you remember the big book in the early program said restitution, restitution, restitution. So she helped me with that. So for example, a couple of the amends I made was, I claimed bankruptcy earlier in my life, and I definitely owe an amends to the attorney who processed my bankruptcy. I had a major resentment towards him because he wanted cash for his services, and I didn't understand why. Gee, took me a few decades, huh? So, you know, I don't remember who that person is, somebody in Minneapolis. So the restitution I did was, I wrote down all the names of all the attorneys in southeastern Minnesota who processed bankruptcies, and I sent them all DA literature at my expense. That was interesting. I found out I also had a major resentment, and I had been I don't need to go into details. Anyways, I had needed to make amends to the major car manufacturers in the United States. Nothing small in my world. And so I sent them letters of thanks for working on creating green products. That was interesting. One of my favorite amends, because it got really entertaining, was I ended up calling a large national publisher who I used to work for years and years ago when I was a student. And I got the receptionist who answered the phone was from New York, so I got this wonderful New York accent, you know. And I told her, I said, is there anybody who heads up this particular office that I worked at years ago? And she said, oh, honey, no, that closed long ago. It was more like long ago. And I said, well, and I took a risk with her, and I told her what I was trying to do. And she was quiet for a moment. She said, oh, honey, why do you want to do that? Just let the past be the past. And I was like, okay. And so I said, well, this will keep me from killing myself down the road. She said, well, in that case. So we came up with a plan, she and I. And she forwarded me to Human Resources and gave me the name and the address of the Human Resource person. So I wrote a letter. And I wrote a letter to several former employers, thanking them for hiring an active addict, thanking them for giving me job skills that kept me from dying as I grew older, And that was really moving. The other amends that I really wanted to make, and always be aware of sponsees who really want to make amends, because it involved an ex-spouse. Oh, yeah, juicy. And I had already made amends to him. And my plan was to do a grand sweeping dramatic gesture and wipe out part of my savings account and send him money because I owed him. And I knew he could use it. And so my sponsor started kind of plugging away at what my motives were. And my motives weren't very pretty. And she said to me, "Did you already make amends to him?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, she said, "What was his response to your offering to make financial amends?" And I said, "He forgave me for them." She said, "Aha." She said, "You get to let him forgive you for that. You don't get to one-up him on this." I was like, ooh. And then she said something really interesting. She said, "Addicts like us cannot stand not to complete the conquest. You get to leave him take the spiritual high ground, and you get to do living amends for the rest of your life." I didn't like that, but I have not violated that direction. Another thing that I really wanted to do was take part of my inheritance, well, actually most of the inheritance, and wipe out my student loan. And my sponsor said, "If you do that, you will be debting inside of 6 months. You don't get to do that. You get to pay this off for the rest of your life, or however long God decides, 1 month at a time." So last summer, I made a decision, with God's help and the help of my PRG and a sponsor, that I would pay the full amount on my student loan every month, no matter what. That's $601, because I let it go for years and the interest accrued and was capitalized into the amount that I do. That student loan started out at $18,000. Currently, it's $58,000. So it is possible to debt and recovery. So I pay that $601 a month. And this is another thing that I learned in recovery, is that when I approach my debts with gratitude, and I say thank you every time. I say a prayer before I open up my checkbook and my record keeping. I say thank you that you've given me the resources to pay my debts. Thank you for the opportunity to show that I'm trustworthy. Thank you for the abundance that you provide. Thank you for letting me help other people do what they need to do by paying my debts on time. And that has really changed my attitude about debting. I used to be terrified of debting, and I'm not. I mean, debting, but paying my bills. I'm very grateful for that tool of gratitude. Steps 10 and 11 and 12. 10, I do an evening inventory, and I make it really simple. I ask, have I been frightened, fearful, resentful, dishonest, selfish, and self-seeking? And if I come up with a clear example, I call somebody and unload it so that I'm not carrying it over until tomorrow. Step 11, I could spend a whole day talking about spirituality in this program. Thank you.
Could you say the 10 again? What are those feelings that you run through?
Actually, it's step 11 inventory. It's actually covered in the 11th step. Is I ask, where have I been frightened? Where have I been selfish? Where have I been self-seeking? Where have I been dishonest? And where have I been, did I say resentful? Okay. And resentful. And my gut knows. I usually get a twinge. So step 11 is not only doing that daily inventory, but it's also doing an inventory on a daily basis. It's also doing an inventory, spot check inventory, where I'm disturbed. The matter's with me. I need to take a look at that. And then there's the longer term inventories where you do once a year or however often you need to do that. In step 12, one of the ways that I practice step 12 is I occasionally go on to phone meetings. And it's really good. It's really moving to hear people from around the country introduce themselves when we get to the introduction part of the phone meeting. There's people, sometimes I often hear people from Germany, and I do the time change in my mind, and they're up in the middle of the night to go to this meeting. Wow, am I going to any lengths? You know, I spoke at a phone meeting 2 or 3 weeks ago and got 16 phone calls for sponsorship. I could say yes to two. That's recovery. There would have been a time when I would have taken them all on, you know. Who needs to work? I'm doing service. So if you have recovery in this program, please make yourself available for sponsorship. It's desperately needed. We're dying from this disease. And step 12 tells me if I continue to work the program, and specifically the steps, and with a sponsor, and keep my numbers, that I will have a spiritual experience that will convert me from being a debtor to being a useful member of the human race. And I would like to read to you my favorite passage in the big book as I close here. "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even debting. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in debting. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward money and debting has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition." And I would add financial condition too. So if you are a mid-timer, if you're a newcomer, please grab a sponsor today. Please grab a step sponsor today who's sober. Start working the tools, start working the steps, and in a year, come back and stand up here and tell us how the miracle worked for you. Okay? Thanks.
Thanks, Deb and Jane. And now I'm going to introduce Kari, and she is going to walk us through the promises, and then we'll do questions for all the ladies.
Hey, Jane
hasn't
gone yet.
What? Jane hasn't gone. Oh, my God. Sorry. Oh, my gosh.
I was fabulous.
Yes. Hey. Jane, I'm totally jumping the gun. I want to hear you. I do.
Reminds me of some auditions I've been on. Next. Hi, my name is Jane. I am a debtor and I am an under-earner. I am so very grateful to be here because I'm having a little bit of midtermitis, so I need to hear some of the things I heard today. I've been a solvent in DA, not incurring unsecured debt since March 3rd of this year was my 3-year medallion. And I got to tell you, no one's more surprised than I am, because there is nothing within me that comes naturally to me that would say, yes, I will daily work this program. Yes, I will write my numbers down. Yes, I will put them in the spreadsheet. Yes, I will do these things, because those things are not things that come naturally to me. I didn't know that when I first started going to DA. I would look at the people in DA and I'd be like, well, those are those solvent people. And they have more willpower than I do. They're smarter than I am. Those are the people that know how to make this happen. I don't know how to make this happen. Interestingly, I never asked those people how they did it, because I didn't really want to know, not right off the bat. The only thing that keeps me solvent is the knowledge that I have a disease for which there is no cure. There's only a daily spiritual reprieve. I am convinced today that if I stop talking to my sponsor, stop talking to my fellowship, stop going to meetings, I will be in worse trouble than I was the first day I walked in. So what does my disease look like? Let's take a look at Jane's brain on drugs, on the drug of debting. So at this time, I'm living in New York. I wake up in the morning and I don't have a wall to my bedroom, and I'm listening to my roommates making noise, and I resent them and I'm really mad at them because I have to get up and go to work and I have to go and clean houses, which isn't fair, but I'm a struggling artist, don't you know? And that's a very, very moral thing that I struggle because you can't be a good artist unless you struggle and you go through a lot of pain. So I get up and then I argue with myself about what I'm going to eat for breakfast. I find my one good pair of pants that actually fit me and they're not really clean. Do I wear the good pair of pants that aren't clean or do I wear the other ones? And then I put the good pair of pants on. I go down, I get my breakfast, I eat it on the subway as I'm going to go do my cleaning job, and I'm feeling sorry for myself the whole time I'm on there. So then I start to think about the people whose apartment I'm about to go clean, and I'm like, you know what, those rich people have no morals. Those rich people just, they're so shallow. They know nothing. They know nothing about me. They judge me by my pants. And those people are bad. Because they judge me by my pants, and I feel very bad for myself right now. And I go and I clean the job, and I hate every living second of doing that job. And I sit down and I watch their television for a while. And then I get up and I finish cleaning the job, which I now really resent because now I'm really mad at myself because I spent 15 minutes of my time watching their television, which means I don't have enough time really within the 4 hours to complete the cleaning job I'm supposed to do. I get their money. And the next thing I'm thinking is I need toothpaste. I smell. People don't like me because now I'm sweaty and I smell like bleach and sweat. And I need toothpaste. So I go to CVS and I stand in front of the toothpaste aisle and I'm like, you know, do I really need toothpaste? I don't have to get toothpaste. I should brush my teeth with baking soda and salt. Because that's what good people do. They brush their... I don't need toothpaste. Okay? So then I get back on the subway and I'm on my way back and then I'm starting to feel really bad for myself because I don't have toothpaste. So I get back off the subway. I go up to my favorite Barnes & Noble and I buy a bunch of books. And you know, I have another addiction too. So the hamster in the wheel keeps going. It doesn't stop. It doesn't matter what's going on. The hamster keeps going because life is not fair to me. And I would pray when I was in my disease. I would say, God, if you had to make me fat and ugly, couldn't you have at least made me rich? And I would think, you know what? Those rich people whose apartment I just cleaned, you know what? When I have money, and when I'm rich, I'm not going to get that bathroom towel. I'm going to get the other bathroom towel. You know what? That woman right there, she should not be wearing those pants with those shoes. Said I in my one good pair of pants that are 4 days dirty. So then, you know, I can't really read the book and at peace unless I go get my other addiction, which is like ice cream in vast amounts, and then try to sneak it up into my bedroom. And I spend the rest of the day not dealing with the bills that came in, not answering the phone because I'm afraid of who it is. Because I know that the phone bill's not paid. I know that I haven't given my roommates money yet. And it's hard to hide when you only have 3 walls to your bedroom. Or if it was a little bit later in my disease, it was the apartment where I looked out my window at razor wire. That's what my life was like in the disease. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I went to a DA meeting and I heard someone read this thing in the big book that talked about an ego reduction. I was like, I don't have an ego. I can't stand myself. That's not my problem. I don't need my ego reduced. I need money. These people don't know what they're talking about. I went to DA hoping that someone would just give me money. And I would, you know, I would think about my relatives. I'm like, none of them have money. I'm not going to get any money when anyone dies. That's not fair. This is the way my mind worked. It was moral to be poor, but someday God would make me rich. And I would be able to buy the right things. But for today, I'm going to brush my teeth with baking soda and toothpaste and read my books. Baking soda and salt and read my books. That's the way my mind worked on drugs. The drug of debting. And it didn't stop, ever. And the longer the disease went on, the more progressive it was. What I'm trying to say is it kept progressing. It got worse. It really got worse until finally life was so hard. So finally I'm sitting on the stoop in front of my apartment building and I'm like, the cleaning company won't give me any more jobs because I haven't paid them the commissions I owe them. And I'm not going to be able to pay my rent. If only I had, and I always had an amount of money that was the magical amount. I could make it if I just had like $300 more. If I could just get $1,000. And then an inkling fell into my brain. When I wasn't sure I was going to pay the rent. I was like, Jane, it does not matter how much money you have. You don't know what to do with it. And you will never have enough. And that was step one for me. Then I went on the subway. and I saw a guy on the subway who smelled like urine, begging for money. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not a drug addict. And I'm watching him and I'm thinking, there is no difference between you and me. You're begging to go get crack or alcohol or whatever it is. I would be begging for 25 cents for a little Debbie cake. That's me. And I don't know how to get out. That was, for me, step one. I went to a DA meeting. If you are here, you've done a step. Because I was powerless over my debting, over the way I handled money. In the meeting, I practiced step two because I saw people who had what I wanted. I knew that my higher power would restore me to sanity, or could restore me to sanity. And I wished it was the word would. God could restore us to sanity. I'm like, well, what if he chooses not to? I didn't understand that it was contingent on me being willing to do step three, which is say, okay, if you can restore me to sanity, and I believe that sanity can happen, here's my life. I had been turning my will and my life over to the only solution I knew, hide from the bills. That was my solution. I will live my life tomorrow. For today, I just need to not know for today because it's too painful. It's too painful. And all it did was generate self-hate. That's what it did. Shame, fear, self-hate. Next day, shame, fear, self-hate. I was on this treadmill. I've had many times that I've worked through all of the steps in this program in the past 3 years as things come up and just working them systematically, 1 through 12. My step three that really got me to surrender to my higher power and to working this program was a moment on a table in a storefront doctor's office in Brooklyn where I did not have health insurance. And my mother, I knew, was here in Minnesota, and she had been diagnosed with brain cancer. And I was trying to get enough money together to come back home. I knew that my half-sister was going to be having yet another transplant attempt, and I needed to come back home. At this time, I was abstinent in my OA program, so I was feeling everything. And I'm laying on the table because I went in because I hadn't been feeling well. And I told the doctor what was going in. He said, I think you have jaundice. There's something wrong with your liver. And I hear something wrong with your heart. I didn't admit that I couldn't solve it until I was that moment on the table. And I asked myself the question, Jane, if you were doing a call with one of your program people right now, what would they tell you? And they would tell me to read the acceptance pages, which is page... Thank you, in the big book. And I was like, you know what? I accept the fact, finally, that I can't get out of this one. This one's too big. How am I going to have money to take care of all these doctor problems and move back home to be with my family? It's too much. I can't do it. And I began to weep as this woman was putting this goo on my chest to listen, look at my heart. And she thought it was that I was afraid that I would have, you know, a problem that couldn't be fixed. I wasn't afraid of that. I was afraid of the doctor bill. I was afraid at never seeing my mother again. Not because I would die, but because I wouldn't get back to Minnesota in time. The fifth step is that I started talking to people in DEA all the time. A PRG is a fifth step. A fifth step is I have an inventory of the things that are not working, and I'm going to bring them to other people. I can't work the steps alone. I've tried for years. It didn't work. I have to have other people involved in working the steps. I have to come out of my isolation. The sixth step, doing a temp job, going in and training in the morning, getting ready to be willing to let go of the fear that was keeping me in my job with Tibby the crabby lawyer, who I was very afraid of. The seventh step. Today, part of my seventh step is a post-it that I have at work, and it asks me this question: how are you going to be today? Not what am I going to do, not what am I going to make happen, but how am I going to be? And the first answer to that question is always humble. I need to be humble today so I remember that I have a disease. The A step. I had a sister-in-law I loved to hate. It was so much fun. She's from California. I used to resent her just if she came to Minnesota. If she flew to Minnesota to visit other people, she didn't even have to be talking to me. The fact that she was coming, I would be resentful before she got here because she was coming to Minnesota. I became willing to make amends to her, and I was not convinced that it would work until my sponsor was like, you need to make amends to this person. And I became willing because my sponsor told me I needed to become willing. And I did it, and I started writing my amends letter to her. And now the ninth step, the tears just started pouring out of my eyes, and my heart was full of love for this person because the letter started out with the gratitude of what I was grateful for, what I admired about her. And suddenly I realized that all of that loving to hate her was about fear and about ego. Tenth step. Every day I do a 10th step. And doing a 10th step keeps me clean, keeps me in the solution and out of the problem. It doesn't let things burgeon into big, big, big fat problems. My mom died of brain cancer. And before she died, she had to move. She was in assisted living. And she had to move from where her apartment was to the apartment in what they called a memory care. My mother was angry at her children for selling her house, giving away her pots and pans, doing all these things, evil things to her. She was very, very angry. And so I found out that she needed to move, and it was elected that I would be the one to tell her. So I said to her, well, you know how you keep getting urinary tract infections? You know, the doctor wants you to be near a bathtub, and your apartment doesn't have a bathtub. It has a shower. Okay, that's dishonest. She wasn't going to memory care to be near a bathtub. So when it came time for me to do my 10th step, I had to say to my sponsor, I lied. I lied to her because I was afraid of what her reaction would be. And what happened to that consequently is the next day I went back to her and she looked at me and she said, is this where I'm going to die? And I said, I think so. I don't know the answer to that, but I think so. The next question out of her mouth was, Jane, do you really think that I'm a danger to myself or other people? And I said, Mom, you stuck a knife in the toaster while it was plugged in. And I'm afraid. And the nurses think you need to be here, and I do too. It dawned on me after I did that 10-step work, and after I told her the truth, and after all of that work, it dawned on me that this is a woman who's losing touch with reality. And because I was afraid, what I was going to do was lie to her and just twist that reality for her just a little bit more. I am so grateful that I was able to be honest with her when she asked me if this is where she was going to die. Because she could trust me after that and through the dying process. The 11th step, after my mom died and my uncle died in the same week, I had a hard time meditating. I had a hard time praying. I could say things like, thy will, not mine, be done. I could say the Serenity Prayer, but you know what? I didn't mean it. And I didn't think I was that shallow. You know, I didn't get what I wanted. I didn't get that she was dying until she was the day she was dying. And I looked at my sister and I said, this isn't going to end well, is it? And she was like, no. But I didn't get it. And I had a really hard time praying after that. And I went through a pretty big depression after that. And what I learned to do was to think of the people I was grateful for and say a prayer for those people. And then someone else in the program said to me, Jane, if you can't pray, ask other people to pray for you. And that's what I did. Again, I wasn't going through it by myself. And step 12, in doing my 9th step with my brother, he said, you know what, I think I need this program you do too. The biggest service I can give to any other human being is to remain solvent so that the debtor knows that there's an answer out there. And I can't believe that I, of all people, have experience and strength and hope to give to anybody who walks down the street. And I think last but not least, you know, I just want to say that with my sister and her, the big things that happen in life are big step moments for me. You know, the thing about my mom and lying is a big step moment. Surrendering when I had nothing else to do while they're examining my heart is a big moment. But you know when the steps really count? It's the little stuff. It's when I say, I want to just ship this money from here to here, and I want to write down this thing, but I'm not going to put that down in today's spending plan. I'll put it on next week when I have more money. That's when I have to work the steps. All of this is practice for the big stuff that happens, but unless I'm working the steps on the little things, I'm going to relapse. And I got to tell you, I don't really feel like working my program right now. I don't. I don't want to. I have a case of I don't want to. So I just got done doing a production of a show, and I don't want to do anything right now. I don't want to. But I know that if I don't, I'll go back to where I was, and it's only going to be worse. And that's what keeps me moving. But more than that, I have people from this program that I love dearly. And the daily spiritual reprieve is better than any miracle pill anybody could ever get me, because it makes me keep getting back on my knees and saying to my higher power, please. And it keeps me on the phone with you people. And I like you. I pass.
Thank you so much, Jane. And now we're going to do the promises with Kari, and then we'll do questions, and then we'll have our closing. Did I do that right now?
Yeah?
I'm Kari. I'm a debtor and an under-earner and a business owner.
Hi, Kari.
I didn't realize I was speaking on all of the promises. But what I was thinking about right now is I was thinking about when I first came into DA, and I didn't even listen to the promises. I thought whatever a promise is, it's not going to happen for me. And I never got promises before, so why would I get any promises now? The promises to me are, when I read the promises, what they say to me is I get to thrive. And I was so used to just like hanging on. I was so used to just surviving. And if I was surviving, that was the best it could be. I couldn't thrive. And I love DA. I love it. I love DA. I love BDA. I love visions. I love recording my money. I'm not kidding you. I love PRGs. This program has turned my life upside down. And I'm not saying that there aren't days or nights where I'm like bawling my brains out, completely struggling because I'm in some sort of spiritual growth phase and something that I have to look at and something that I have to work through. And I mean, I'm not in that phase like right now at this moment. So I can say that, but I think it's very interesting that I even know what I love, because when I first came into DA, I had no idea. I think I'm going to skip around a little bit, but one of my first PRGs I had, my first PRG, actually, they wanted me to make a list of 100 things that I loved. And first of all, I thought they were nuts. And I thought, how is this going to help? You know, we hear all these stories about PRGs. And I had to grieve my life of, like, you know, as a grown adult, I had no idea what I loved. I had no idea what I liked. And I have spent so much time in this program, getting clarity about who I am and where I want to be. And so I'll just get into the promises now, I guess. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. In DA was the first time that I experienced spiritual freedom. And for me, physically, how that comes out is like there's like a skip in my step. I never had a skip in my step. I think the last time I remember having a skip in my step, I was 5 years old. I also know how a physical sort of presence of a spiritual freedom is like a squeal. I can have a squeal. I'm wearing this hat today. It was $28. When I saw it, I had a squeal because I loved this hat. I've worn it every day after I come home from my job. I put it on every day. I had no idea I was going to wear it today, but then I thought, oh. It's a symbol to me that before DA, I would buy everything just not quite right for myself. Just a little bit below bar. I would fill my life with so many things below bar that when something like this, I couldn't even notice something that I loved. I'd spent all my money on things below bar, when I did see something I liked, there wasn't $28 available. Which on a side note, I just think it's really important to say that all my debting was on credit cards was groceries and gas. That I debted because I was always worried there would never be enough. And so that's a lot of my debt is groceries and gas so that I could use my other income to buy other things. It's nuts. I learned in this, we are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I learned in this program that there's a season for everything. That there's a season for grieving, there's a season for renewal. There's a season for relationships, for reflection, for action. There's a season for waiting. And that things are always evolving and nothing is stagnant. We're always changing. And my disease tells me that I need to know what I'm going to be or what I'm going to do or who I am, and that needs to be the same from this day on. That's what my disease says. But I've learned that what I am today is good enough. And what I'll be tomorrow is good enough. And what I was yesterday is good enough. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I know that this program is really slow for me. I want things. I was the go, 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 more, 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 catch up, catch up, catch up. Never could, never could, never could. And this program is a very slow, very slow program, but it's steady and it's stable for me. And I've never had that before. I've never had steady, stable. I've always been up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. I think that there's an example of a recent example. With just a refrigerator we had to buy, and we paid cash. And, you know, I think normally I would have bought, like, the dorm-size refrigerator just because it was, like, $400 as opposed to, you know. Or I would have, I think that's normally what I would have done. The other thing I could have done is I could have got the stainless steel version, you know, and gone, like, way, like, this is, I'm gonna show the world that I deserve abundance. I'm gonna get the stainless steel version. You know, or something like that, depending upon, like, what mood I was in. And we just got, like, a regular middle-of-the-line refrigerator, but we got the one with the freezer on the bottom and the refrigerators on the top. And the whole weekend, the first weekend we had it, my husband would go by and hug it. I'd be like, I love our refrigerator. And I'm like, you know, that wouldn't happen if we weren't in DA and we didn't know that it was a spiritual refrigerator. Like, it's not, we didn't get the refrigerator that... we got the refrigerator because we're working a spiritual program. Like, it's not real. It's, yeah, it illuminates. It's wonderful. It's just a plain old white refrigerator, but it's cool. And that's what I mean. Like, and it's the first appliance that I've ever bought, and my whole entire life, it's the first appliance I've ever bought. I'm just trying to think, we'll not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Savings plans, debt repayment plans. You know, I was the kind of debtor that would pay off the whole chunk and then just put it all back on the next month. pay off the whole chunk, put it all back on. I never had savings. Now I have savings, and it's itemized according to visions. I have a prudent reserve. I have a contingency fund. You know, my prudent reserve goes down when I am go through a stage where I lose some income, but then I build it back up slowly. I don't try to just repay the whole big chunk again. I save slowly and steadily, and same with my debt repayment. And I've paid off more debt in DA than I never paid off debt before. It's just by doing the minimum required, because I was steady and stable when I paid it off. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. This program is all about me being comfortable in my own skin. I don't know how that happened. All I know is that I was terribly uncomfortable in my own skin all the time. And that the only thing I know is I work this program. I show up. I go to meetings. I work the steps. I'm of service. And as a process of that, I mean, as a result of that, I am who I am today, and I'm okay with that. And that's good. It baffles me that I'm okay with that. And then I think about that on sort of like a money level. It's not about the money. And people used to always say that to me all the time. It's about how I am, where my serenity's at. And if I'm off in my disease, restless, irritable, and discontent, I remember once doing an exercise, a sponsor saying to me, well, why don't you pretend that you have $1 million and tell me, you know, where you'd put it, how you'd spend it. And it wasn't enough money. It wasn't. And I'm really good with numbers. I even did a third savings, you know, debt repayment. It wasn't enough. And I that was proof to me that it's not about the money. Because when I'm spiritually free, I don't really think about needing $1 million. I'm just really content where I'm at for today. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experiences can benefit others. When I first came into DA, I was living with my husband, as a grown adult, married adults, in someone's attic. And it was just that we didn't have our own bathroom, we didn't have our own kitchen, we shared it with them, we helped them pay their mortgage. And I moved from the attic to like a beautiful duplex. I thought it was a beautiful duplex. And that shocked the heck out of me. I thought that I had to move. Like, I had to make baby steps. Like, I thought, okay, since I'm moving out of an attic, now we need to move to like a studio apartment. And then we get to move to like a one bedroom. And then, you know, that I had to do like, I have all these rules of how I need to do things. And I got to jump right into this beautiful home that we had for many, many years. And the miracle about that too is that when we went to go sign the lease with the landlord, we saw the 12 steps, the big book on his coffee table. And I still have like this very intimate relationship with him. I don't even live with him. I mean, I don't even rent property from him anymore. That's a DA miracle. In my disease, I wanted to buy a house with a patched up window. You could look, it was like cemented shut. You could look from the front, from the street front, and see it's cemented shut, because I was so tired of looking at houses, and I felt like, oh, we don't have enough money. We're never going to be able to buy a house. Let's just buy this one. It's pretty good. You know? And the realtor said, it has a patched up window. And I said, well, you know, I mean, everything else, it's pretty good. Pretty good. She said, do you want to buy something that's pretty good? And I thought, well, that's normally what I do. And it was really painful to not buy that house and to trust that there was going to be a better house. We got our with the work that we want to put into it, I feel like we have our dream home right now. And it was less than I would have paid for the patched up window house. And it's totally a miracle of Debtors Anonymous and of PRGs. There was a time that I drove to, in the program, I had $14 in my checking account, and I had to deliver artwork to a gallery 45 miles away, and I was putting quarters in my gas tank, and I had no idea. I had 2 more weeks to live on that $14, and I had no idea what to do, and I called my sponsor at the time, and he said, just go anyway. And I never would have gone before DA. I would have canceled. I went, and the gallery owner said, well, you know, we do things a little differently here. We buy artwork straight out. And so she just wrote me a check for all the artwork, and I drove home with the next 2 weeks spending plan plus the following 2 weeks spending plan in a check. And had I not worked my program through that, I never would have received those miracles. All these miracles take, in order to receive miracles, I have to set myself aside and listen to what others have to say. And then, you know, no matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. There are days where I feel where I'm just in my disease, and I feel like all the old patterns, all the old thoughts, all the crazy stuff comes back to me. But I still pick up the phone, and I still talk to the sponsees that call, and I hear myself telling them, and I completely believe what I'm telling them, and it's so helpful, because I think if I completely believe this for them, then this must be true for me too. And it's also, I think it's good for them to hear that I'm suffering. But I'm here, and I still want to do this. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. You know, well, I think I can most simply say that, but I found myself in this program. I really did. I think different people find themselves in different ways, but I definitely found myself here. And all of you helped me do that. I could never do that alone, or by hiring somebody, or by anything. I just, how many self-help books I could read. I was born to read self-help books. And I found myself here, and I can't even tell you how. It's just the miracle of this program. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. And I guess just like immediately right now, what I'm thinking about is my husband and how before recovery, I had like a tally system. He gets that. Well, then I get this. Or it was always like, well, if he, you know, today he bought a plane ticket. And I thought, wow, like normally before this program, I would have said, okay, now I should buy a plane ticket. So we're like, everything's even. And he has his, you know, it's not even like, it's a literal, it has to be literally even. Plane ticket for plane ticket, you know. And I know now that we all get our visions if we work this program, and we all have different visions. And that there's a world out there that has limitless expansion, and that there's enough for everyone, and that I don't have to keep a tally system. All I need to do is worry about what my visions are and what my work is in the program. All I need to do is take care of myself. And now I can experience complete, and just like a squeal for him buying his plane ticket. I mean, it almost feels just like how it feels for me when I have something manifest in my life from this program. We will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Well, I have a few tools here. Prayer and meditation. I might use my God box where I put all my anxieties and my worries and my troubles in the morning. I bookend all the time. I make a call. I say, last night, I had to bookend. I'm really having a hard time punching out of work. I'm taking it with me. It's on the couch with me right now. I would call back later. I just finished watching a movie, and I can't punch out. I'm still not punched out. I need to bookend. I need to talk to a sponsor. I need to make my phone calls. And this prepares me for handling situations where that used to jump up and, like, surprise me. And now, because I think it's because I'm more comfortable in my own skin and I'm more clear and I'm more present that, and I'm breathing, that I'm able to handle situations that used to baffle me. Self-seeking will slip away. Well, this is a very interesting one because self-seeking I used to equate with self-care. And a lot of you probably know that this program has a lot to do with self-care. I learned everything I know about self-care in this program. I've moved from a place of starvation and deprivation to a place of self-care. And a good example is last night when I had a really hard day at work and I knew that I needed to pick up some good food. I needed to pick up a good movie. And when I got home, I needed to take a shower and put on some clean sweats and my hat. And I was, you know, that was going to be my demonstration of my self-care. And when I can do that, when I do that, then I can be of service to other people. If I don't do that, I'm not answering the phone. I'm here today in without my hat, or you know, I don't know. It's just I'm different. Then it's a proactive way of taking care of myself. And we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Well, no kidding. Wow. I think that the biggest example for me with this in the program is PRGs. It's surprising to me how many PRGs. I mean, I've had so many PRGs, and I've been in so many PRGs. I love PRGs. I love the outcomes are always such a surprise to everyone in the PRG. And I guess I want to say limitless expansion again. I get that idea of like limitless expansion when I'm in a PRG, that anything is possible and everything is possible with a higher power. And I think the latest example that I have of that is one of my recent PRGs. I was under a lot of pressure because of an art business and I'm teaching full time. And I think I had like 6 weeks until a big show that I had, and I was really behind in getting work ready for the show. And the PRG just matter-of-factly said, well, you need to take time off. And that's something that in the midst of it makes my, like the demons come out of me just like, that is impossible. Like just like it, and it feels like painful. Like I'm going to have to ask for time off. Are you serious? No. Like, I mean, I just want to like resist it and just, oh, and it's, I mean, I have to bookend going into the administrator's office and asking for this time. And I just want to say as a teacher, you know, you're given like spring break and winter break and summer. So nobody, you know, you don't really get any other time. It's very unusual to get other time off. Well, I went into my administrator's office and they said I should ask for 7 days. I went into my administrator's office and I sat down and I just said, I just wanted to let you know, I'm under a lot of pressure to meet this deadline. And I want to know if there's any way we can work together. and in me getting some time off. And she and I said, and then I actually said, or she said, let's talk about that a little bit. And I said, well, do you have a general idea of how much time you could give me off between this date and this date? And she said, about 7 days. And that's a miracle too, because that is unheard of. Just like it's unheard of for a gallery to pay you directly after delivering, it's unheard of for an administrator to just say you can have 7 days off in the midst of 6 weeks. I mean, for me, in my head, it's unheard of. It's not in this program. If it's God's will, it's possible. And if I just keep showing up to meetings, working my steps, working with my sponsor, picking up the phone, these things happen, and they continue to happen. And I am so grateful to be here. Thank you for having me. And I'll pass.